Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Rachel Beatty-Riedel, and standing in for my co-host as well, Kim Yi Dion. So this week's episode is the first episode of our new non-resident fellow team, and Bamba Ndiaye, who's also the host of podcast The Africanist, will be leading this episode, which focuses on recent developments in African activism, starting from the early days of the Arab Spring in Tunisia in 2010 and carrying through to the current moment, particularly in Senegal. The episode discusses the exponential rise of protest movements, resource mobilization and strategies using digital platforms, art and music, as well as the challenges faced by African activists in pursuit of their mission. We feature two esteemed guests, Sophia Diniz-Sow, who is the founding member of the Yanomar movement in Senegal, one of the most prominent social movements that continues to inspire contentious politics on the continent, and Zachariah Mompili, the Marx Endowed Chair of International Affairs at Baruch College, as well as an affiliated faculty member in the Department of Political Science at the Graduate Center CUNY. Now, Professor Mompili has studied recent political uprisings on the continent and actively participated in the first major African and diasporic social activists gathering, the Popular University for Civic Engagement of the 21st Century in Dakar. And so this pair will simultaneously bring the activist perspective and the scholarly perspective on the state of activism in Africa. Now, given this episode, I'm going to dedicate a brief news wrap to a few important and related things happening in Senegal and in Francophone West Africa. So apropos of this week's topic, I saw a headline this week that said Senegal bans protest. Yes, indeed. Senegalese authorities banned a protest this past week that had been planned for January 6th, saying that the place chosen for the demonstration was subject to major construction work ahead of the country's Independence Day celebration. But supporters of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, who had called for the protests, say that authorities feared the demonstration would embarrass the government because it was a response to a new report that was published last month by the Court of Auditors, which found irregularities in how the country spent $1.5 billion of COVID-19 funds. And so that was the issue that the protest was meant to take up. Now, a previous demonstration was also called by civil society organizations that took place on December 30th. And in response to the report, the administration of President Macky Sall said that the failures identified in the report accounted for less than 1% of the total funds. And Amnesty International decried this act of banning protests in Senegal was a major violation of civil liberties after planned street protests in Dakar had been blocked earlier last year in June. So there's obviously a lot of contention in Senegal around who can protest and when that's allowed and when it's shut down. And that relates to a major topic, the Senegalese two-term limit. So Senegalese President Macky Sall has come under attack recently for refusing to confirm that he is not going to run for a third term in the country's 2024 elections. This a third term run would be unconstitutional. Past presidents in Senegal have sidestepped that unconstitutionality either by making constitutional amendments and then declaring that it was a new start and other workarounds. So there is precedent for judicial ruling that that a president could run again, depending on the circumstances. But Macky Sall has not ruled out the possibility, despite many calls for him to do so. Last week, Senegalese economist Felouine Sarr published an op-ed and described this kind of inability to confirm the lack of a third-term run as Macky Sall taking an authoritarian drift, and one that takes, quote, the Senegalese people hostage. Sarr continues, quote, witnessing in disbelief the erosion of what has made our country a nation that has been able to avoid the ethnic religious conflicts, military coups, and civil wars in a post-colonial Africa struggling with multiple upheavals. He warned of protests in the country that would arise, as there were certainly a decade ago against the former president Abdoulaye Wade's third-term bid, and that the country is expecting Macky Sall's announcement that after being twice elected as the president of Senegal, that he should not run for a third term, and in doing so would respect his oath of office. Now, one other little piece of news out of Senegal, talking about film and art and literature and the ways in which social activism is inspired and often takes on social causes and sheds a poignant light on issues of the day. This year, January 2023, marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of the father of African cinema, Ousmane Sembene, the Senegalese novelist and filmmaker, and really such a leader and luminary, who published 10 books and directed 12 films across a very distinguished career. So there's a great article in The Conversation, we'll post links to it, that has different descriptions of many of his novels and his films, what they were known for, pointing out a few of the key works, like his biting satire, Ngzala, which means the curse, in 1974, and psychological realism film, Black Girl, in 1966. So there's so much there to engage with, of course, as a novelist writing God's Bits of Wood. And since his death in 2007, Sembene's status as a pioneer has really been truly cemented by the sheer variety and richness of his work, his ability to reinvent himself as an artist, moving from literature to film. And it's really worth looking at that article and what's made his career so remarkable as a creative force, and taking in some of his work. Okay, one last thing. I promised this would only be on Senegal, but there's breaking news on Benin. Benin held parliamentary elections on January 8th, 2023, so just last week, and opposition parties took part in these elections for the first time since President Patrice Talon came to power in 2016. So really historic, mobilized elections. President Talon, who is an economic powerhouse, a cotton magnate, called the King of Cotton in Benin, had barred opposition parties from participating in the 2019 legislative elections. And only two political parties were allowed to take place in the 2021 presidential elections. Both of those were allied with President Talon. So most of Talon's key political opponents have either been jailed or forced into exile. And so this is the context, the environment within which opposition parties decided that they could and would take part in these 2023 legislative elections. Now, results were being tallied all last week, but as of today, Friday, January 13th, Benin's Constitutional Court affirmed the ruling coalition's victory, as well as the return to parliament of a significant number of opposition parties. So the final tally showed two political parties that are already in power, those two that participated in the 2021 elections, Union Progressive Le Renouveau, UPR, and Bloc Républicain. So those came in first and second with 37% and 29% of the votes, respectively. And the party, the opposition party of former president Yayi Boni, Les Démocrates, came in third with 24%. So Yayi's supporters now have been leading demonstrations, protests, social activism since 2019 after opposition parties were blocked from the legislative vote for failing to meet strict new eligibility criteria. None of the other parties that competed, there were four other parties that competed for the 109 legislative seats, gathered enough votes to meet the 10% threshold for parliamentary representation. So other parties did compete, but the remainder of the vote was split among the top three that met that 10% threshold. Voter turnout was just nearly 38%, the Constitutional Court said. And that is really quite low for a country that has taken up such a historic transition in the early 1990s with a national conference and full participation in the democratic future. Of course, it is higher than the the elections that were where opposition was barred from protesting. So with that in mind, a lot of political activity in these countries. Now let's return to the role of social activism and join the conversation with Bamba, Sophia, and Zachariah.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Bamba Njai, and I am one of the Ufahamu Africa non-resident fellows. Today, I have the pleasure to welcome two special guests. Our first guest is Professor Zachariah Mampili. Professor Mampili is the Marx Endowed Chair of International Affairs at Baruch College, CUNY. He will be accompanied in this conversation by a friend of mine, a prominent social activist from Senegal, Sophia Denise Sow. Sophia Denise Sow is a founding member of one of the most prominent social movements on the African continent called YANAMAR, or Enough is Enough. Our conversation today will be conducted in both French and English, and I would like to seize the occasion to thank Margaret Rowley for the translation in this episode. We really appreciate it. So my questions to Professor Mampili will be in English and my questions to Sophia in French. So Zach and Sophia, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
So I'm going to start with you, Prof. In the past decade, Africa has seen a proliferation of social movements and activism. What are the causes of this exponential rise of social activism on the continent?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's very important to understand that what's happening in Africa is not unique to Africa. We are seeing these sorts of protests unfolding in many different parts of the world. You know, I'm sure you saw recently events in Sri Lanka sort of boiled over where the people took to the streets and overthrew the government. And we've seen those kind of protests unfolding in places like Latin America, across Asia, here in North America, as well as in Europe. And so Africa is part of these larger trends. But it's important to recognize that there are also many local factors that are driving it. And so it's, you know, it's almost impossible at this point to comment on every single protest that has been unfolding in the African context. But in terms of the larger trends, what we have seen is that there has been this profound loss of faith in governments around the world, driven, I think, by sort of the increase in economic inequality that has been, you know, unfolding across the past couple of decades in this neoliberal era of ours, where, you know, people have really lost faith that governments around the world are working in their interest. And so I think what we see globally is happening in an extreme fashion on the African continent. I think, as you are probably aware, many African countries have grown tremendously in the past couple of decades, largely fueled by investment from China and other Asian countries. And much of this wealth has really been captured by a narrow political and economic elite in these countries. So we've seen a huge increase in GDP, but also a massive increase in inequality across Africa. And I think this is what has been fueling young people in particular to take to the streets and challenge these unjust conditions.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, pour continuer dans la même lancée, Sophia?
To continue in the same vein, Sophia, you are among the founding members of one of the most prominent social movements on the African continent, YANAMAR. How and why did the movement come into existence? YANAMAR was born at a very special moment. It was born on January 16th, 2011, during a conversation among friends, journalists, rappers, students, and myself. We were without electricity for hours. There were corpses decomposing in morgues, children dying in hospitals, and things like that. And during discussions, Fidel Barro said to Chat and Khalifa, who are from the same rap group Kirgi Crew, "You are committed artists. All this time you've been denouncing the government in your music and nothing changes. What are you waiting for to do something about this or to act? Because we must no longer limit ourselves to lyrics." At that time, there were elderly people living in Gedouai who were protesting against the power cuts there. So Fadel said it was cowardly of us to leave this fight in the hands of senior citizens. Khalifa and Chat told him, You're an investigative journalist too, and all this time, what have you done besides write articles? Why don't you do something much more concrete? And that's when everything started. In this discussion, we said we're not going to create a political party. We're not going to do what we're used to seeing here in Senegal. We will create something that will crystallize Senegalese people's frustrations. We tossed around several potential names for the movement, and Yanamar stood out. Then we wondered how to create it, with whom to create it. We thought we should call all the committed artists, students, and journalists, etc. I remember that same evening, Chat called Malatala, also known as Fumalad. He was the first to join the movement. He called him to tell him we started a movement called Yanamar. Malatal didn't even let him finish his remarks. He said, I adhere to it, everything Kirki Crew does. Fidel Barro and Aliou Sané, who were investigative journalists, were tasked to contact journalists and draft a communique that they shared with their colleagues. And on January 18, 2011, we launched the movement at the Place du Souvenir in Dakar. And I must say that at that time, I did not have previous experience with social movements. I was just one of those people who would talk and complain without doing anything in return. I would never fathom being part of the kind of movement that we're talking about here. And through these discussions that we had that day, I realized that it was up to us to take our destiny in hand and to break with fatalism and participate in the change that we wanted. And that's how Yanamar movement was born. And we saw a lot of participants, a lot of young people who identified with this movement and who espoused its philosophy.
Merci beaucoup pour cette réponse, Sophia. Since the inception of Yanamar in 2011, we have seen that they have a tremendous impact on the continent, on social activism on the continent. And one of the things that they helped initiate was the UPEC in 2018. UPEC means Université Populaire de l'Engagement Citoyen, in English, Popular University for Civic Engagement. In 2018, you took part in the UPEC, which was a Pan-African gathering of social movements. What was the significance of this event, and what were some of the major takeaways from it, Prof?
Yeah, so I think it's absolutely essential that we see the kind of collaborations between social movements that UPEC was trying to foster and is still trying to foster with the Afriki network. Because, as I mentioned in my first response, you know, many of the dynamics that we are seeing are not unique to specific countries, are really driven by these larger regional and global trends. And I think as we saw in earlier eras, when we had these sort of broad uprisings across Africa, that, you know, the success of any individual movement was often tied to support that they received from other movements. And the only way you can kind of bring about that type of solidarity is to provide spaces and opportunities for activists in one movement, in Senegal, for example, to be in conversation and in solidarity with other movements, like movements in Congo or Burkina or many other places that sent delegations to the UPEC network. And we know now, 4 years later, that many of these movements continue to remain in touch. And so I think that kind of strategy is essential, because one of the common themes we've seen across Africa is that these movements are facing very dire conditions in their home countries, as governments really have chosen to try to crack down on the movements rather than to find ways to incorporate them and to listen to what they are trying to articulate. And so activists have been arrested, they've been imprisoned, they've been tortured. And you often need support from the international community, from Pan-Africans around the continent, in order to provide, you know, respite from the relentless government assault against activists across Africa. I would say that, you know, to me, that's the key legacy of UPEC, and what I would love to see are many more UPECs going forward.
Sophia,
we've seen in a short amount of time, Yanamar built a continental or even international reputation. What justifies the success of your organization? First of all, you have to know that this form of protest movement with Yanamar never existed before in Senegal. For the first time in Senegal, we saw a people stand up and fight together for the same cause in the country's interest. And Yanamar has a great chance to bring together several branches of society. But its greatest asset is that it is composed of rappers and journalists who have a listener and follower base. Yanamar got closer to the people and made them understand the purpose of the movement's struggle. Senegalese people quickly appropriated the philosophy of the movement because it was different from what they used to see. It was not a political party, but young people who stood up to fight. And we must also know that Yanamar knew how to federate a whole people for a common cause. It knew how to involve every citizen in its fight. The movement participated in the awakening of consciences. It made Senegalese people understand that it was necessary to break with fatalism. We must also not minimize that Yanamar possesses a great communication and mobilization force. And all this was done through extensive accountability campaigns, awareness campaigns across the country, community visits, educational concerts, and through the urban guerrilla poetry. Yanamar really interacted with the populations, and apart from that, social media like Facebook have greatly contributed to popularizing and enhancing the struggle of Yanamar. The movement reached a much wider audience beyond Senegal. Besides social media, there was the local press, which has also allowed the movement to be known at the national level and beyond our borders. This has greatly contributed to making the movement known throughout the world. This is what has also allowed Yanamar to inspire and collaborate with several movements in Africa.
In the same wavelengths, Prof, I was lucky to be at the UPEC in 2018. And I remember during your intervention at the UPEC, you mentioned something that stuck with me, that social movements should engage in what you called utopian thinking in order to be successful. And my question is, what would such an engagement look like or entail, and how can it help disrupt the political status quo?
I think what I was trying to convey at that time in 2018, which obviously was pre-COVID, and it was hard to imagine how much the world would change in the next few years, back in 2018 when we all met in Dakar, was that, you know, there is a way in which social movements are charged with an impossible task, which is to provide a path forward against what seem to be insurmountable odds. And so, you know, the concept of utopian thinking is an old one, but basically what it is trying to do is to imagine possibilities beyond the status quo, as you put it, right? And I think if we look back at 2018, and I would say even today, despite all the things that have changed, you know, the most common response when young people in particular are demanding transformational change is to suggest that, you know, they're being naive, that they're ignorant, that they don't understand how politics actually works, that they don't know how to make compromise. And I think these are all mechanisms that have been designed precisely to deactivate oppositional movements in particular. And so for me, I think, you know, what the role of the activist is, what the role of the social movement is to reject such narratives, to push back against the idea that we simply have to accept the current political, social, economic arrangements as they are, even as so many of us around the world recognize that they are not working for the vast majority of the human population. And so I think that requires a different way of thinking, right? A willingness to embrace big ideas, a willingness to ask uncomfortable questions, a desire to imagine, you know, futures that we want rather than we're told we must accept. And I think all of this is an essential part of what activists do, right? Activists have always been at the forefront challenging injustice by showing us and by offering us visions for a possible future. And to me, that remains something that we have to constantly remind people, because, you know, being an activist, especially with movements like Yanamar that have been around for over a decade now, it's really disheartening. It can be very difficult in the face of overwhelming odds to keep going. And I think part of the way that we keep people motivated is to help them understand that what they're doing is not simply about getting one party elected versus another, not about making, you know, small changes at the margins by getting a few more diverse people elected to office, but rather about re-envisioning the fundamental relationship between government and people. And that's something that requires a bold act of imagination.
Excellent. And I agree with you that they have a gigantic task. And it is not easy to be an activist anywhere, but especially on the continent of Africa for several reasons. And to talk more about that, Sophia,
since the advent of Macky Sall's regime, some have criticized the Yanomar movement for not being as critical as it was to the Abdoulaye Wade regime. What do you respond to those criticisms, and what has changed since then? First of all, we have to know what they mean by being committed. What does committed mean to them? Because the periods are not comparable at all. The presidency of Abdoulaye Wade and that of Macky Sall are not at all comparable. The contexts are not the same, and nothing has changed in terms of Yanomar's commitment then or now. The movement has remained the same. It is always present whenever necessary. Yanomar has never turned away from its trajectory. It should be remembered that from the first year of the Sall regime, Yanomar was the first and only entity to warn and remind the regime in place of its electoral promises with the initiative Digi Burla Gor Tawakhte. A promise is a debt and must be honored. And also, it is important to know that thanks to Yanomar, young people are more and more engaged and are more and more interested in politics and community management. How many movements are born thanks to Yanomar? How many committed young people are now part of a social movement? We must not limit ourselves to the people we are used to seeing, such as Chat, Fumalad, Ali Usane. That is really not knowing what Yanomar is all about. You can't fight certain political practices and replicate those same practices. Yanomar's fight has always been to instill a patriotic impulse in young people, and it has succeeded. Yanomar is you, it's me, it's the mechanic, it's the lawyer, it's the fish seller, it's the Senegalese people, it's the African continent. Therefore, we must not forget that Yanomar is not only about protest, it is also projects and solutions. The movement believes in skill building and encourages young people to take charge of their own destiny and to expect nothing from the authorities. And this is done through awareness raising campaigns, especially on youth entrepreneurship through initiatives that we've put in place. These initiatives are a response to the challenges faced by some communities and allow young people to develop their entrepreneurial spirit and civic engagement and to contribute sustainably to the development of the country and to bring out real agents of change and especially effective development actors. So to say that Yanomar is no longer so committed is really not knowing the true philosophy of the movement. And Yanomar has had a lot of impact in many African countries. Several countries have created similar movements. I can give the example of Burkina or Mali, Guinea, Togo, Benin, and so on. And there are branches everywhere in Senegal and even in Europe, in the United States. The branches in America are still there, are doing an excellent job. There are young people who are in the movement and who represent it with dignity. I can cite the example of Khafour or Sambaloum, Pap Diallo, and many others. And these young people have understood that We Are Yanomar is, it's about volunteerism, about determination, and that Africa has potential and that it's up to us to use them to their full value. And these young people have understood that. Now it all depends on what these critiques call commitment.
Mm-hmm. I like that response. Merci beaucoup. Thank you. And to go back to Zach, so you started talking about some of the issues that social activists and movements on the continent face on a regular basis. So could you elaborate more on some of those obstacles that these movements are facing?
Well, I think they're myriad. I mean, I think there's a relationship between the political situation that we are observing in many African countries and the larger global economic context that we are living through in this moment. You know, I think one thing that is very important to my research is to situate the ongoing African wave of protests within the larger historical and global context. And if we look back, you know, at African history, we can learn a lot from our ancestors from the past, who fought amidst similar periods of global reordering, right? So if you go back to, say, the 1940s and 1950s with the anti-colonial struggles, obviously those were movements that took place within specific countries, but they were also taking place within a rapidly changing global order, right? With the demise of European imperialism, largely as a result of World War II, the rise of the United States and the Soviet Union, that gave movements in Africa opportunities to kind of take advantage of new players like the Soviet Union and the United States, for that matter, and to really sort of maneuver at multiple levels, not only at the local level, not only at the national level, but also at the global level in ways that proved determinative. If we look again at the 1980s and 90s, when we saw a similar wave of African protests, again, that was a period characterized by tremendous flux at the global order, in the global order, with the demise of the Soviet Union in particular. And that actually led, again, to some major victories, right? South Africa becomes independent, largely as a result of tactics developed by activists that put pressure on the apartheid regime in Southern Africa, but also put pressures on governments around the world, including the United States, right, which was one of the key supporters of the apartheid government. And that led ultimately to the collapse of the apartheid regime. So I think, you know, with the rise of China in particular, we are again living through an era where there is a lot of potential with these movements if they can develop strategies at multiple levels, right? And I think governments are always going to, sadly, try to crush and repress these movements instead of recognizing them as bountiful expressions of popular energies coming from young people in particular. But if movements can play their cards right, I think there is potential for them to navigate around the repressive tendencies of African governments. And what I'm hopeful for is that, you know, they are able to devise these sorts of, you know, interlinked, networked global strategies, first to survive the onslaught, which is inevitable from governments across the continent, but to develop strategies that can really take advantage of some of the changes that we're observing at the global level.
Mm-hmm. And to stay on that theme of repression,
Sophia, I'd like to know how the Yanomar movement is navigating some of the obstacles that are posed by the government, whether it's repression, imprisonments of activists, or other obstacles that are related to mobilization. Can you tell us about these obstacles that the Yanomar movement encounters?
This is obstacle rencontre le mouvement Yanomar.
You have to know that the movement encountering obstacles is not new. From the very beginning, we've had a lot of threats and intimidation attempts from the Wad regime up to now, but Yanomar has always been able to overcome this. We don't let others intimidate us, and we are ready to fight back. We are ready to fight at the cost of our lives, as we had always done with President Wad, and President Macky Sall is aware of this. President Macky Sall knows it. He witnessed all of it. He was part of the struggle. He joined us at the Obelisk Square during the protests we led under the Abdoulaye Wad regime. He knows that. But we've seen a real democratic setback since Macky Sall got to power, because President Wad, at least, he let us demonstrate. With Wad, we had the right to express our opinion. We had the right to oppose what he wanted to impose. But with Macky Sall, it's the opposite. No one has the right to speak up. Anyone who speaks up ends up in prison. Anyone who speaks up is beaten up. We saw the example of the activist Guy Mariusanya, who went to a community and was beaten by residents, and there were no consequences for the aggressors. And if they were the people in power, the police would be tracking us, intimidating and arresting us. But if it's civil society, social movements and so on, nothing happens. There's no follow-up. But we will not let anybody intimidate us. We will keep fighting anyway. Although we're all in danger, but it won't affect us. And President Sall knows that very well. His supporters know that. We are not intimidated. We will keep fighting. I can't finish this interview without talking about women's place in the Yanomar movement, but also in social movements in Africa in general. Can you elaborate the place of women in Yanomar and in African social movements? That's a question I don't like to get into, something I don't like to talk about because I don't see men or women. What I see is a human being, just the human being. Many criticize me for not speaking in public or why do I not want to be visible in public, but the goal is not to speak just to speak or to be visible. We have a spokesperson for that. I don't need to show that I'm here because I'm just a woman. All I need is to fight for my country and to be present whenever my country needs me. And I think I do that, and I do it well. I've been on this movement for 10 years, more than 10 years in the field. There has not been a single time when I have not responded when my country needs it. There's not a moment when I have not been there with my people to fight certain practices and to fight alongside them. I've always been there whenever I needed to be. I was there 10 years ago, and I'm still there, fighting alongside my people. Whether people see me or not, whether I speak or not, I've always been there, and I've never had limitations within the movement. Because I am part of the core of the movement, I attend the core meetings of the movements. I was part of that body that made all the major decisions at the time, and I'm still part of that body. I've been in every meeting, whether it's rallies, caravans, demonstrations, or whatever. We also must recognize that there are not as many women as men in the movement. But women are there. They represent the movement with dignity. They represent the movement in Senegal and elsewhere outside the country. They're very present. And we are also lucky that within the movement, men are not macho, we must admit. They've always fought for women to be at the forefront. In my case, I don't need to put myself forward or not. The most important thing is to lead the struggle, to take part in the struggle, and to bring my contribution.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So we are almost at the end of this conversation, but as usual, I like to ask my guests less loaded questions, and starting with Prof, top three dishes.
You mean from anywhere or from...
From anywhere. From top food, like food that you like and cannot live without.
So I am from South India, so I do love South Indian breakfast foods in particular, you know, the dosas and vadas and appams and all that kind of stuff. I think I'm a big fan of Ethiopian food as well. And I did love the Senegalese cuisine that I was able to sample when I was in Dakar.
Which one in particular?
There was a rice dish with fish that we shared collectively with a bunch of activists at the Yanomar office. Yes, Tebogen, of course. Ah, man, that was delicious. And your chilies are quite spicy as well. So that put the cherry on the top for me.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Sophia, same question.
What are your top three dishes? So the top three dishes you like. My favorite dish is Tebogen.
Tebogen?
Ah, ouais.
Tebogen wins.
It's Tebogen. I know. That's my favorite. Other than that, anything we bring, I'm okay with it. I like beans too. I like white beans, Tebogen, and supukanya.
Supukanya, okay. Ah, that's good. So, bro, second question. Top three novels that you've read so far and that you would recommend to anybody?
Huh, okay. I just finished the book by Vahuni Vora called something about King Rao, The Amazing King Rao, or something like that. It's a sci-fi novel that I highly recommend. Very interesting kind of examination of the near future in terms of technology companies and what they're doing to us as a society. A little bit dystopian, but I think was quite interesting. I'm always a huge fan of The Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, which I'd read at the beginning of the pandemic again. And I think really sort of gave us a vision of what our near and long future could look like. I'm a big science fiction fan. And the absolute book that I recommend to everybody these days, if you have just a whole bunch of time on your hands, is the three-part series called The Three-Body Problem, which is a Chinese novel that, again, is a science fiction book that not only looks at our near future, but is actually looking millions of years into the future. So I found that to be a fascinating take. To come back to our theme about utopian thinking, it's really important for us to stop focusing on, you know, what happens this week or next week, and to really start thinking about, you know, our futures as a human race across decades and even centuries.
Excellent. Same question to Sophia.
What are your top three favorite novels? I haven't read any novels for a while, but I like to read the novels of Agatha Christie or Mary Higgins Clark. I like that genre of novels, but I'm more of a movie fan. I like that. There you go. I like to watch investigation movies. What are the three movies you can suggest to our listeners? I like Usual Suspects. I like horror movies too. It's kind of weird.
Okay. And then the last question, Prof. So top three places that you have not visited yet and would like to visit at some point. So top three places that are on your bucket list.
Oh, that's a great question. I would say a couple of weeks ago, I finally got to see one of my favorite musicians of all time, Umu Sangare, play here in Harlem at the Apollo Theater, which was just a lifelong dream, really. I've been listening to her since I was a teenager. And so I've always wanted to go to Bamako. Bamako, you know, obviously I know it's a difficult political situation in Mali right now. But, you know, just in terms of the sheer musical cultures that have emerged from that city, I would love to have an opportunity one day to travel and just listen to some music in Bamako. Outside of that, you know, I think Patagonia in South America. I've never been there, but I imagine it as a just stunningly beautiful landscape. And then third, probably there's a part of northern India up in the Tibetan Plateau called Ladakh, and I've never had a chance to visit there, so I'm hopeful one day. I would love to take my son. He's a very outdoorsy kid, but I would love to take him both to Patagonia and to Ladakh, God willing.
Excellent. Exciting places. I've never been to Bamako, and it's one of the places that are actually on top of my list.
We should go.
Yeah, we should go. Let's do it this summer, maybe. Sure. So, Sophia,
if you have to choose three places that you haven't visited yet and want to visit in the near future, what would those three places be?
Vous voulez visiter dans un futur proche. Quels seront ces trois endroits?
Without hesitation, I mean, Egypt, Jamaica, and Brazil.
Oh, that was quick.
That was quick.
I don't like to travel too much, but I do want to visit those places.
Get to go to all those places sometime soon. And we maybe should just organize a group trip and all of us can go together, like on a world tour.
Maybe the next UPEC should be in Bamako.
I know, right? Sophia, you heard that.
Okay,
great then. This will be an opportunity for him to visit Bamako.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for coming to this joint podcast between the Africanist and Ufahamu Africa. And this is part of the Ufahamu Africa Fellowship. And I'm very grateful to be part of this new cohort and very grateful that you guys were able to come to the first episode of this series on African social movements and African activism. Thank you very much, Professor Mamphili. Thank you very much to my friend, Sophia. And I hope to see you guys very soon, maybe at the IPEC. And I hope that you will also have the chance to come back to the podcast and share more about your research, activism, and engagement. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bamba. Great to be here. Good to see
merci,
you, Sophie.
Merci, Zakaria.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of UFA Hamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takono Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tanyiko Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.